I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about forgotten books. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. What better company could I have? Gina Bereka, inducted into the Friars Club, professor of literature at UConn, and author or editor of 26 books, including It's Not That I'm Bitter in paperback. Perfect company for many reasons, especially Gina's love of great writing and great stories. It was Gina who suggested we resuscitate books nobody reads anymore. There are books that are time-bound and classics that seem always relevant. Edith Wharton's books come to mind for me. Gina, welcome back, and this is a great idea for a show.
Thank you so much, Faith. I'm absolutely delighted to be here, as always, and talking books.
Yeah, so what made you think of this?
It was not the most literary sort of beginning to this story for me, but there was a book that I loved when I was a teenager called Where's Papa? And they made a movie out of it, but it was not the movie. The film had Ruth Gordon in it. I think it was very funny. But the book was passed around in my high school so that I ended up with the copy. And it, I think inside it said 1973, so I was like a sophomore or junior. And it was hysterically funny so that I found it while looking through this paperback falling apart. You know, when the paperback, the really cheap mass market paperback, when the pages crumble so that you can't even turn them because edges are so brown that they're falling apart. And I started to reread this paperback that was covered already in duct tape, you know, like duct tape, like for, you know, industrial stuff on the cover. And I was laughing until I was crying in my office at home so that Michael came into the room. My husband came from his office into my room and said, "What the hell are you doing in here?" And I said, "I'm reading this book." He said, "What's the book?" I said, "It's Where's Papa?" And it's by Robert Klane, K-L-A-N-E. And this is somebody who went on to write screenplays. But this is, you know, somebody who was never famous as an author. And then I thought, let me go see, because I have old friends from those days. And I thought, let me go see if I could buy some used copies.
Yeah,
this
these
must
are
be
around.
Out of print. Let me see what I can find. I went on to El Libris and the used bookstores, you know, Abe Books and The Strand. Copies of this book are selling for $200. That it was so not unpopular.
Yeah, and loved by a set of...
And it was a cult. I mean, this is now a cult classic, so that my lousy paperback is going for $45. I mean, that one that has, like, you know, there are ads that say poor condition, you know, spine broken.
We'll take anything.
Pages missing. It's $45. So that book was Where's Papa? P-O-P-P-A by Robert Klane, and that's K-L-A-N-E.
And we have this list at our website right now. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. You'll also see the Food Schmooze link if you're hungry. Gina Bereka is here. So when I was making my list last night of what I call forgotten books, it really is based on not hearing anybody talking in the book show or in my private life about certain books. And so I have no evidence that what I'm about to say is true. But I thought to myself, Catherine Ann Porter, is it true? Because you teach literature. I love her work. I never hear anybody talking about her.
She is somebody, I would put her in this category. This was Catherine Ann Porter, Ship of Fools. Right?
Yes.
That these were books that made a huge difference in the lives of the people who read them. And Catherine Ann Porter, I have heard certainly spoken about as one of the great American writers. I remember in graduate school, a professor of American literature that I was taking said, if you buy a book, you have to buy a Catherine Ann Porter novel. And I don't think I've heard somebody mention her in years.
I read her about 15 years ago, maybe 20. Let's say between 15 and 20 years ago. She is studied in, as you know, in colleges and universities, but not so much in regular culture, in popular culture.
Right. And I think actually,
I almost fell over. She was so good.
And I think that what's interesting is that there are trends of writers who get taught and that remain in sort of, therefore, sort of public consciousness. You know, people go home from school. My students say, oh, I went home and I told my mother I was reading this, or I told my dad we were doing this in class, and he goes, oh, I remember that. There's a kind of a continuity. But when people stop being taught, where they nobody's making movies about them anymore, they're not part of the public conversation, their books go out of print, their name doesn't come up, and they are no longer sort of – they no longer have a place literally on the shelf of popular culture. So that even if we know somehow they're great, we're not talking about them. We're not really reading them, and they go out of fashion.
And what this is doing for me right now is I thought to myself, well, I can't remember what Ship of Fools is about. Mm-hmm. But I have to go back and read Katherine Ann Porter again. Right. Here I'm bringing up her name, and I don't, you know, you just don't remember.
Right.
Can I just slip in one more thing and see if you check me out on this? Because this is in the Katherine department. I adore the books of Katherine Mansfield.
Oh, see, now I teach Katherine Mansfield.
I bet.
Absolutely, because she counts as in my modern British literature classes. But she's one of the great short story writers of all times. I actually quote in every time I teach the modern British literature class, I quote from her journals. I'm not a great journal reader. I'm not heavily biographical in the way I teach these courses. But Katherine Mansfield's journal is so moving, and where she talks about, she actually says, risk everything, care no more for the opinions of others, do what you must do, fear nothing, write for yourself.
Oh, this is her journal.
This is from her journal, and she's urging herself on to do this, because half of the journal, she wanted her journals destroyed, and her husband, John Middleton Murray, publish them in a way to make money. This is at least the story, to make the money to pay for his next marriage after she died. And so we're grateful that we have her journals, although you feel like
kind of retirement planning.
It really wasn't such a great thing. But she suffers in a way the same sort of fate that Dorothy Parker suffers. Flannery O'Connor, another writer that not enough people read, Flannery O'Connor, who wrote A Good Man Is Hard to Find and short stories.
Well, now, let's come back for 1 second to sure. Katherine Mansfield. Of the books of short stories, what would you recommend? What do you teach?
There are various collections. You could pick up almost any collection of her short stories. So that the Garden Party is, I think, often it's collected under the Garden Party, because that's one of her more famous stories. But there are stories of hers, and probably people could find them even online now.
When I read her the first time, again in this period of about 15 to 20 years ago, I said to myself, this might be my favorite writer.
Now, she's amazing, and she's somebody who, if I have my students read, there's a story called Bliss, and it is devastating. It's such a piece of social satire, and it's heartbreaking, and it cuts your throat. And I teach it alongside with a much more well-known, canonical text, which is James Joyce's story from Dubliners, The Dead. Right. So everybody has heard of The Dead, and, it's one of the most famous Joyce stories. But Katherine Mansfield's stories make a lovely pair, and it's sort of the feminine version of these experiences. But because she only wrote short stories, she's not considered a great writer.
It's too bad. See, the timing is everything.
Absolutely.
If she were writing now.
Right. She'd be Alice Munro.
Or Laurie Moore or something. Right. So tell me what period she was writing in.
She was writing from the early teens, of the turn of the last century until, I think, the late 20s, early 30s.
Okay. So we've talked about Katherine Ann Porter and Katherine Mansfield. And you did Where's Papa?
Where's Papa, which is, again, not in the same league. Not in the same league. Robert Klein's Where's Papa? But now, another book by a woman writer who was a big hit in her day. And this book went into, I think, 19 printings in the year it came out. It was a wildly successful dark horse bestseller, and it's one of the funniest books I have ever read, alongside of Where's Papa? But Where's Papa is real slapstick. Robert Klein's book is real slapstick. This book is called With Malice Toward Some, and it's by Margaret Halsey, Halsey.
Uh-huh.
And it is a series of letters that she wrote about spending a year abroad with her husband in England. And this was, again, I think it was in the late 30s. And it is one of the funniest books where she talks about staying at these little, you know, houses that are residential houses, traveling with her husband who was doing research. He was an academic. And how she says, you know, walking into the hallway of this B&B, it clearly from the smells emanating from the kitchen, it was human sacrifice night. You know, I mean, she was writing really horrible things. And about the English, where you expect everybody to be so polite about the English. And this woman, and it really, you hear her voice coming through in the letters. I keep it next to the computer because when I need somebody to remind me how to write funny, I look at Margaret Halsey. Nobody knows her.
I cannot wait to read her.
She's hysterical. It's called With Malice Towards Some, and it's Margaret Halsey, H-A-L-S-E-Y. And she's somebody, unlike Robert Klein's book, she's somebody, because the book went into so many printings right away, you can find her in used bookstores.
And she was writing in what period?
She was writing in the 30s and the 40s and actually up through the late 50s. She has a number of other books. She wrote about actually working at a soldier's canteen during the war, and where she's got a book titled Some of My Best Friends Are Soldiers, and it's about the lack of segregation in the military canteens where the black soldiers were with white soldiers, and what it was like for the girls, the women working these places to deal with an unsegregated population before that happened across America.
And here's what we're going to do. We have a break coming up. I am with Gina Borecka, who is an author, Psychology Today columnist, UConn literature professor, certainly knows books. And we're doing a kind of extra book show from a different point of view this time. Gina and I are talking at her suggestion about the books that got away, the books that nobody reads anymore. And I guess we're saying should be brought back, should be read. Oftentimes they're still out there, if not online, they're in libraries, on people's dusty bookshelves. So have a look at these. This list is posted right now at WNPR.org, our website, search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. As we take our quick break, we have lots more books to tell you about, so stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. You'll see the list of forgotten books that we're discussing right now. And right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and much more. Click on programs for the Faith Middleton Show at WNPR.org, and you will see the link to the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze in case you're hungry. Gina Borecka, let's continue with this. Gina, I went online to see, you can Google anything. And I went online to see, I typed in the sentence, books nobody reads anymore, and it is an entire category. People do nothing but discuss this topic, It turns out. So here was one, and just this one sentence made me want to read it. You might know this. The Girl Who Laughed by Edna Ferber. It is about a newspaper woman in a man's world. Now, you just know that's going to be good.
I have that book. No, I do. I have it. I haven't read it, but it's one that I bought probably 2 years ago at one of those used book, you know, fairs that, you know, they'll go to whatever the antique fairs are and they'll have some books. And I feel like I'm the last one. And that actually had a beautiful cover. But Edna Ferber is one of those writers that we should all be reading. I have a student now who's doing an independent study on women's suffrage literature. And she was bringing Edna Ferber sort of back into my consciousness. So I feel like, okay, Edna Ferber's ghost is here, because to have her mentioned twice in a week to me after not hearing about her, you know, for 2 years since I bought that book. But anytime that you find one of those books by somebody like Edna Ferber, Fanny Hurst, H-U-R-S-T, who wrote Backstreet, these were important writers in their day because they were giving voices to women who had never really appeared as autonomous creatures in these novels before.
So The Girl Who Laughed, Edna Ferber, and Fanny Hurst, Backstreet. Okay. Now, there's a category, that, as you well know, of famous people, you know, famous writers who have classics that will go on and on. I bet this is on your list because I have a couple here.
Okay.
So one of them would be Edith Wharton. I think people don't read Custom of the Country quite so much by Edith Wharton. And then people online had another one of hers. Go ahead.
Well, Custom of the Country is wonderful because
I love that
Undine
book.
Sprague, right? That's the Custom of the Country. And she's great. One that I actually did an introduction to for the Signet Editions, and I don't even know whether their Signet Edition is still in print. That might have gone out. It was really an obscure one, but it's fascinating. It's called Glimpses of the Moon. So it's Edith Wharton's Glimpses of the Moon. And one of the reasons that novel is amazing is because it's sort of the comic version of the book that we all know by Edith Wharton, House of Mirth. It's mm-hmm. what would have happened if Lily Bart and Lawrence Selden had actually gotten married. What would have happened to them if they were together? It's not easy. I mean, the relationship that she depicts in Glimpses of the Moon isn't easy, but it's a comic novel. But it's really like a what if, like if you wrote a happy ending to, I don't know, like Tess of the D'Urbervilles, you know, which would be really hard to do, actually. But if you wrote like, and she didn't get hanged, she was, you know, she walked off with Angel Claire, which probably some fan fiction has already done. But Glimpses of the Moon is a really fascinating, and it has all of the Edith Wharton stuff. It's got the letters where there's blackmail. And
oh, can I ask a question? In the beginning of that novel, does it open with them in Italy?
There's a whole section in Italy. Yeah.
I started this last summer because I was on an Edith Wharton tear. And I started this and I got about a chapter in and it just didn't grab me. And so now I wish I'll go back and I will
I'll
try
give you
it again.
One of my copies with the introduction.
Oh, okay. Where
so
you explain
you
it. Okay.
Why.
So let's see what those are. That's Edith Wharton. My version of the one that doesn't get read quite so much. Maybe I'm wrong. Custom of the Country. I adore this book. And Gina, yours
the
is.
The really obscure one is called Glimpses of the Moon.
Okay. Now online, this chattering group says that they think Edith Wharton's Ethan Frome does not get read very much.
See, now is that true? Gets taught all the time.
Isn't that different, though? Because I read all kinds of books in my English classes in college, and I never hear a word about half of them.
Yeah, yeah. No, Edith, I mean, in a way, one of the sad things about, and that could be a whole other show, but the books that we teach to people when they're too young, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we give high school students Ethan Frome by Wharton, or we give them Silas Marner by George Eliot, or, you know, we give them even Wuthering Heights or Jane Eyre. You're too young to really grasp the big themes in those books at 14 or 15.
I want to read Jane Eyre again.
Jane Eyre is the longest novel about adultery. It's about adultery. I mean,
yeah.
Jane Eyre is there as the governess. The wife's in the attic. I mean, the wife is there the entire time that Jane is being courted by Mr. Rochester. You got the wife locked up in the attic. I mean, if you think about Jane Eyre, she is without knowing it, but it's a novel about adultery. She's being courted by this married man. It is something that you don't really have a sense of until you're, you know, been around the block a couple of times.
And she wrote that when?
Gosh,
roughly?
No, 1850 something.
So that was that pretty provocative?
No, I mean, it was really, I mean, I don't think that people
all
ever,
too common.
I think nobody ever looked at it. You know, people don't look at it as a novel about adultery because it's, you've got the mad woman in the attic, to go back to the book that Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubar wrote, but the sort of other self that's up there. But if we go back to, like, let's say, look at Wuthering Heights as an adult, I mean, you've got more sort of necrophilia, bizarre, vaguely incestuous stuff going on. It makes all of this Twilight stuff look like what it is, which is child's play. I mean, you want the really deep, weird stuff. Go back to the Brontes, because they were really doing very strange things. Mm. But as a predecessor, I got two books even earlier than the Brontes that I think should be read. One of them is by somebody who we all read or we all have read, which is Jane Austen.
Okay.
But it's a book that most people don't consider worth the attention that all the other books get. It's called Lady Susan.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah, Jane Austen's Lady Susan. It's a very early novel of hers, written as a series of letters. It's an epistolary novel. It has one of the meanest, most villainous characters. Lady Susan is really the prototype for, like, Scarlett O'Hara. She is manipulative. She's full of sexual wiles. She's Machiavellian. She's just the kind of character that you can't imagine. Everybody thinks of Jane Austen as sort of sweet and and nice and gentle. She was absolutely sort of the snake in the tree, sort of hissing. She is presenting these characters. Jane Austen makes these characters into a lot more of the temptresses and the seducers and the manipulators and the ones interested in money and graspingness and sex. And Lady Susan, when I teach that book, my students are shocked because they've, the upper division lit students say, how could this be? Is this a newly discovered manuscript? No, it's always been there. But because it doesn't fit with the Jane Austen books, people like get nervous about it. I think it's absolutely wonderful. It's a fun read.
So that's Jane Austen's Lady Susan.
Lady Susan.
What was your other one that you, early by someone we
early,
would know?
Right. It was George Eliot. Right, who was writing, 100 years later, writing in the 1850s again. And she wrote a very weird little novella called The Lifted Veil. And it's supernatural. It's sort of science fiction. It's about a man. It's really wonderful. It's about a man who can read everybody's thoughts. That's his curse in life. He can read everybody's minds. And so he sees the despicable things, the shallow things, the envious things. I mean, all the horror that's actually inside everybody's soul. And he falls in love with the one woman whose mind he can't read. And then some bad things happen. And it's really, there's bits of Frankenstein in it. You've got little Mary Shelley parts. You have the reanimation of the dead. You've got all of this stuff that's nothing. George Eliot is known as this realist novel, right? She's got Middlemarch and The Mill on the Floss and Adam Bede and Silas Marner. And then here she's doing this weird stuff where they're breathing, life back into the dead body by the end of the book, and mind reading and telepathy.
Wow.
It's great.
What a thing. George Eliot, The Lifted Veil. All right, here's what we're doing. Gina Barreca is here, author or editor of 26 books, Psychology Today columnist and UConn literature professor. She's here to talk about the books few people read anymore. I have a list, she has a list, and we're reading from a big list. There are chat rooms about this online. And the list of what we think are some great reads, books that many people have forgotten about, is at our website right now, WNPR.org. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Okay, here's what they're saying online. There are so many people who started talking about Marjorie Sharp. You know this?
Yes, Marjorie Sharp, because she was a humorist. She's another one of those humorists.
I can't believe – I will just say Marjorie Sharp, because I could go through a zillion books. Fanfare for Tin Trumpets, Four Gardens, The Flowering Thorn, The Nutmeg Tree, Something Light, Martha in Paris. They sound fun. I think, who is this? So worth reading in
you? Absolutely. I mean, she's I wouldn't put her in the first tier, but I mean, I'd certainly put her in the same, it's like in the Where's Papa category. I mean, these are
lighthearted.
Right, exactly. These are fun ones. These are good reads.
You give me one.
Okay. I've got people need to go back and reread Robert Benchley.
Good idea.
Robert Benchley, I get his books wherever I can find them, in any used place, and I'll get them in any condition. One of his early books, I mean, just the title. The title of the book is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or David Copperfield. Because this is Robert Benchley deciding he's going to sell the book no matter what. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or David Copperfield, whatever you want this to be. And, he was a columnist for The New Yorker. He wrote for everything everywhere. He wrote for sports papers. He wrote, for the Boxing News, for the Racing Times, but really for The New Yorker. He's a riot. And I had only discovered Robert Benchley after memorizing everything that Dorothy Parker has ever written. Mm-hmm. And because they shared an office at the New Yorker building, and that Dorothy Parker described as, if this had been any smaller, it would have been adultery. And she was filling in for him. A lot of Parker's very funny reviews were when he was abroad and she was filling in for him, and they always ended with, Robert Benchley, please come home. But Benchley is just one of the funniest writers that you can't. And now what I'm realizing is, now having read everything that he's written, is that every American humorist says that Robert Benchley is their favorite writer.
So humor gets dated, and even though people are revered for their wit, it requires something of you to get into that mindset. It's almost impossible. Does his humor still work today, or does it feel like it's of a period?
That's a really interesting question. I think you can see it almost like there are sepia tones in it. You can, you know, like looking at an old photograph, but when he gets it right, it's absolutely timeless. There are pieces mm-hmm. that could be written today and that in no way do you have to sort of distance yourself or imagine yourself being back in those days.
So I have someone in his league who also wrote for The New Yorker and would like to suggest this. It's E.B. White.
Oh,
I'm crazy
sure.
about him. So he's written many, many things and people read them all the time still. But this thing that I'm talking about is his essays, the essays of E.B. White. And I highly recommend this. I was crying laughing reading one of the opening essays about what it was to move out of his apartment. I had just moved, and I literally was crying. I read it out loud to someone I know who'd moved, and I was crying again laughing. I mean, it's brilliant, brilliant, and it's so great to read these essays on so many different topics, and you think, what a guy.
Absolutely. And his books have been reissued over the last several years. In fact, there was a beautiful essay about New York. It's sort of a long essay.
I just reread
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous essay. And I can't remember who actually did the preface, but they did sort of a gift version
Roger Angel.
Oh, it was Roger Angel. Okay, who did that, just that wonderful piece in The New Yorker. Yeah. So that is a book that I have bought for like every student of mine who has moved to New York, because there has to always be somebody moving to New York. And so I bought like 10 copies of that. Oh. And I give them to the students who are moving, because it's a love letter to New York. But his writing, you're right, that E.B. White's, what is it, The Last Tree from the Corner was one of the collections of essays. And they are. It's the same kind of precision in writing. And they're funny, but they also, there are ones that get your throat. I mean, that's
some,
you know,
political.
Yeah, very political. And very, he also wrote sort of a science fiction one about, you know, they're men in a space station and they see the Earth being destroyed. And it's this apocalyptic, but really brilliant, that could be written now. It's mm-hmm. much better than half of the post-apocalyptic stuff.
Well,
we
that's
see.
The thing about E.B. White. He wrote in the, I just reread the New York one. I think I've read it three times now. It's a little book. And in it, he's talking about, and this was back, when did he write this? In the 40s yeah. or something, or 30s. And he's saying, I look up at these towers, meaning tall buildings mm-hmm. at that time, and think that a plane could just come and crash into these. My jaw fell open.
Yeah.
Just the idea of New York constantly changing, and we still know it's – he hit it. He really described
right.
New York.
You know, and they're timeless, just as you said. They really are timeless. And I think that that's true. If you say, you know, E.B. White, they know him from Charlotte's Web, or people know him from Strunk and White, but they don't know that he's a writer on his own. Along those lines, if I can throw in another name, is a writer who these guys admired, I believe. I mean, I know Benchley did. But somebody that most of us don't know is named Jerome K. Jerome. Now, have you ever heard that name?
Yeah, I have. How do I know it?
Maybe because one of his really popular books that is still in print is called Three Men in a Boat.
Oh, that's it.
Right. It's a classic. It's the one book that people know him from. It's, again, hysterically funny. It's sort of a travelogue, but it's really sort of a novel where he sort of catalogs this time when three friends and a dog, not to mention that it's three men in a boat, not to mention the dog, and it's this sort of picaresque little trip that they all take and the adventures that they have. But he wrote essays that were also very influential in their day. The first collection was called Idle Thoughts of an Idle Fellow. And then there were Second Thoughts of an Idle Fellow. And those essays, you could see Benchley and White and, for that matter, you know, Jean Kerr and Irma Bombeck and the women writers in Parker following along those lines. Because what Jerome K. Jerome really did was to come up with humor that was based on a small incident, a small daily incident, but would then take it to a larger sort of absurdity, but then somehow
– So Seinfeldian.
So, yes, absolutely, but in print with a – so that there was like a more, you know, complex sort of thing. But then always in the middle of it, and it was a student of mine who put it this way, there was always a moment of tragic relief, because while you were laughing, there would be one line – where something serious, you would get the bigger idea behind it, so that there was something about laughter in groups. And it's this wonderful essay about how important it is to laugh. And then there's a little story at the end of the essay about how there's a group of people laughing at this woman who was drunk. And he was writing in the 1880s, 1890s in England, in London. And how they're laughing at this drunken woman. And, you know, a little girl comes up and she seems to be scared. And he says, "No, it's okay. It's just a drunken woman." And she said, "No, sir, you don't understand. It's my mother." And the whole thing has been about laughter. And then you get this and then you're like, ah. I mean, it just absolutely makes you stop in your tracks. And then he goes on saying, but you don't know what the community is and you don't know what laughter can do. And then there's like another take on the whole thing. He gets you, but then he teaches you something in a very non-didactic way. It just puts you through the experience. Jerome K. Jerome, Idle Thoughts of an Idle Fellow.
It's a good one. All right. So online, someone is saying, "Goodbye, Mr. Chips," by James Hilton, that people don't read this anymore.
And I think that there are some good reasons people don't read Mr. Chips anymore. Do you remember the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I reread it because I thought about teaching it in a class I was doing on books about teaching and literature about teaching. And that is dated.
It is.
It is.
Okay. It doesn't hold up.
Doesn't hold up.
Well, that's okay. Some people adore that book. And so it's in this chat room about books that aren't read anymore and maybe should be. Okay. Gina Breck is here. We're going to take a short break and then come back with many more titles to tell you about. This is like opening up a whole other world of books to read. Stay with us.
I've been working on my rewrite. That's right. I'm going to change the ending. Going to throw away my title.
You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. Gina Bereka is here. She's the author or editor of 26 books, teaches literature, is professor at the University of Connecticut, is a blogger or columnist for Psychology Today and the Hartford Courant, and so is a very busy woman and has been on the show practically since the beginning. And so for many, many years, we have been together and doing this, and it's always the best, Gina. I'm so glad you're here. And Gina had the idea of doing this show. If you love to read, we're coming up with ideas from you, a little bit different from the theme of the book show, because Gina thought, why don't we go back to books that people have forgotten? It's the kind of book that can grab hold of you, but nobody reads them anymore. Sometimes people read them in school, and then they're just forgotten, but they're still good and interesting. So we have suggestions for you, and I went to a chat room online that discusses this, and these readers have views for you. So, Gina, how about this one? Up the Down Staircase by Bell Kaufman. I don't think I've ever read it.
Oh, Up the Down Staircase was one of the first books that absolutely captured my attention. I wrote a book report on it in fifth grade, and my teacher called my mother at home and said, "Did you actually allow your daughter to read this book?" And my mother, who is a very shy, very quiet woman, who was very intimidated by teachers. She didn't graduate from junior high. And she said, "My daughter can read anything we have on the shelf that she can actually understand," and defended me. It was a big deal because there were swear words. Up the Down Staircase is a book about a girl who goes, a young woman, who goes straight from college to teaching in an inner city, New York City high school in the late 50s, early 60s. And that's what Up the Down Staircase refers to, because it's going the wrong way. It's like going against the rules. And she learns how to teach. And it's told through letters, through notes that the kids write, through bits and pieces, discussion, dialogue from the classroom. I think that's still, unlike what we just talked about, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, that mm-hmm. still works. I have students who are going to do Teach for America or teaching through AmeriCorps. I recommend Up the Down Staircase to them. It is one of the best books about teaching, especially that you could give a young teacher, because she is challenged on every single thing that she does with her students and with her peers. And she actually, Bell Kaufman, who I met once, she's also was Shalom Aleichem's granddaughter. Huh, and so okay. She comes from a real storytelling tradition. I think this was the only book she ever wrote.
So that's Up the Down Staircase by Belle Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N. Again, all the books we're talking about are listed right now at our website, WNPR.org.
I think that one of the books that everybody should read is Stella, and I'll just say that categorically, is Stella Gibbons.
But don't feel bossed around.
Exactly. Not me. I would never be bossy. Is Stella Gibbons, G-I-B-B-O-N-S, Cold Comfort Farm. Uh-huh. Now, Cold Comfort Farm, people have heard of it because they did like a BBC adaptation back, I think, in the early 70s. The phrase, I saw something nasty in the woodshed, comes from Cold Comfort Farm. The English know this book really well.
Yeah.
And they made a film out of it. I think Ian McKellen is in it, probably about 10 years ago. But the book is really worth reading. It is, Stella Gibbons wrote a bunch of books. This is the only one that has any staying power. And it really does work still. It's a sort of a parody of D.H. Lawrence, of Jane Austen, of other novels where there's someone who comes in from the city and tries to get the barbarians in the country onto, you know, the right way of thinking. And the young heroine says that what she wants to do is to write a book almost as good as Jane Austen one day. But until she does that, she's going to go into the country and sort of fix her cousins who live out on Cold Comfort Farm. And they have you know, cows that are named Feckless. And they have, you know, it's this bizarre, really sort of sexy, interesting, high modernist novel. Again, I think written in the 30s. And it's just a riot. And I've taught that book, and the students love it. I mean, they're shocked by how much fun it is.
It's timeless in terms of age as a read. The way I came to that book is Chester Kerr, who is a former publisher of Yale University Press, and started an imprint there, Tigner and Fields. And he came over to my, we were friends in addition, he came over to the office and he handed me, he said, I have just had this reissued under Tigner and Fields' label because people have forgotten this. Read it and you will love it. So 20 years ago, this was still the case. People were saying, you know, if you'd read it, oh, this was one of the great things. We can't let this get dusty.
And again, everybody does love it. So why do it's so fascinating to think that why certain books at certain moments have traction. You know, why is it that, you know, that there are these books that everybody keeps rediscovering? Why don't they stay discovered? That's really one of the big questions. Like, for example, my students now at UConn, they have never watched the film, let alone read the book, Gone with the Wind. You would think that Gone with the Wind, right?
Wow.
The American classic. I said to this last class, very good, last couple of years, these last classes of students, well, certainly you've seen Gone with the Wind. Your mothers must have sat you down or your dad's talked about the army stuff in Gone with the Wind. Never saw it. And I taught Gone with the Wind in a femme fatale course. And the students again were amazed, like, this is like, I thought, oh my, because it still is. There's a 1,000-page novel, and they were very intimidated. And I said, you will sit down and you will start reading this over breakfast, and that you're going to walk around bumping into walls because you're going to want to keep reading this. This is not a book you're going to want to look at the spark notes and find out what goes on. You're going to want to read this. And they do, but it is no longer part of the conversation for you, right? We're growing up because you would assume somebody's seen Gone with the Wind.
The typical dinner conversation is, I've seen the movie or read the book 16 times. You know what I mean?
No more.
Especially for young women. It was the classic that taught you about relationships and the romantic this, that, and the other thing.
No more.
Wow. Okay, how about in the chat room online about this, books no one reads anymore, Mrs. Miniver is mentioned by Jan Struther, S-T-R-U-T-H-E-R. And I have... will confess, I've never read Mrs. Miniver, have certainly heard of it a million times. I don't know why I've never read it. I don't even know what it's about.
Okay, now that, I'm with you on this one. I feel like I've sort of earned my keep because the other books that you've mentioned, at least I know, but this one, Mrs. Miniver, I think it was a movie. If I were on a game show, I'd say a movie with Greer Garson.
It was a movie.
Right? But that's it. I got nothing else on that one.
Okay, what do you have
then? What I have here, another fascinating book that I enjoy teaching, but that nobody ever has heard of outside of a very narrow group of sort of academic life, is Zuleika Dobson by Max Beerbohm. Zuleika, I'll spell the whole thing, Zuleika Dobson, D-O-B-S-O-N. And it's by Max Beerbohm, B-E-E-R-B-O-H-M. Zuleika Dobson is another great femme fatale. She's literally a femme fatale. She causes an entire generation of young men at Oxford to leap into the river and kill themselves for love of her. It's a hysterical fantasy novel. And it's pre-World War One. I mean, so that, you know, the idea of a generation of young men. I mean, again, it's
so do you feel her power, or are you are you mostly in their minds trying to get her?
It's very, very funny. It's the whole book is a comedy. So that, the you know, that's the trouble. I mean, Beerbohm is this great satirist. And he illustrated it. In fact, I think it's a Yale edition. Beerbohm's original, because he was a caricaturist. And he did these fabulous drawings of all of the characters. So that it's, you have a third-person omniscient narrator, and you see the gods playing with these characters at Oxford for sport. And so Zuleika, who is the granddaughter of one of the dons, comes in, and every man at Oxford falls in love with her. Every single man at Oxford falls in love with her, except there is the Grand Duke, who she loves for 2.5 seconds. They have an interesting relationship, and that becomes the sort of core of the story. But Zuleika Dobson remains.
What a funny name.
It's Zuleika, exactly.
It's so funny.
And actually, when I've written about this, I don't know if I did it for the paper, but I've done it for other places. And when I've lectured about it, and people will say, no, it's not Zuleika, it's Zuleika. And then I've had to go back to the preface where Beerbohm, in a late edition, explains how to say her name, and it's Zuleika. And so people, again, it's another cult book.
So we want no emails on this subject is what that really means. Translation. Subtitles on this show. Okay, so it's Zuleika Dobson by Max Beerbohm. The name of the novel is spelled this way, Zuleikadobson. Zuleika Dobson. What about this one, Gina? Because in the chat room on this topic of forgotten books that we should still be reading, they say Christopher Morley's Kitty Foyle. Have you ever read that?
Ooh, no,
I haven't. I haven't either.
Haven't. Again, so, sounds familiar, but no, I don't know that one. How about an underread book by an author that we all know, George Orwell?
Yeah.
And so we all know 1984 and Animal House. But he wrote, I think, a charming novel, but a really socially relevant still today book called Keep the Aspidistra Flying. And they made a film out of it that wasn't very good called A Merry War about, again, 10 years ago, 8 years ago. But Keep the Aspidistra Flying. Aspidistra is those are the plants. They're like the big old-fashioned plants that you see in windows of sort of generic stores and things like that.
How do you spell that?
Aspidistra is A-S-P-I-D-I-S-T-R-A. And he talks about the aspidistra and why it's keeping it flying. It's the flag of the middle-class English people. And so that, you know, they uphold their sense of what's right and what's moral and what's good. But you have a 29-year-old would-be poet writing terrible, terrible poetry. And his girlfriend and his sister and everybody around him want him to make good. And he doesn't want to. He insists that he wants, like, the life of the artist. And so he works at actually a terrible used bookstore. It's a very funny book about the literary life. And I am always interested in teaching it to young people and talking about it with young people, because there's a real question when you get to the end of the book about whether the ending is happy or unhappy. And for the most part, if you ask, and again, this is a generalization, but it's one based on 27 years of teaching at UConn. If you ask young men, is it a happy ending? They say, this is a tragedy. It's awful. This is a misery. I was horrified by the end. And women go, oh, no, thank God. It was really funny. This was just a riot.
I felt that way about the conclusion of Downton Abbey.
I know.
I was like, oh, good.
Really, it's very hard to look at those people and go, well, wait a minute, there's got to be a third guy that she hooks up with. It's not going to be either of those two. They're going to run off together, those two dark-haired men.
But it was kind of a happy ending.
I know,
absolutely. In its way,
it was at least cheerful. There wasn't somebody running under the bus.
Exactly.
So this is what I'm hoping
Nobody
for.
Bumped off.
Nobody bumped off, at least not anybody good.
Okay, so George Orwell, Keep the Aspidistra Flying.
Absolutely. Okay. I think that's, it's another really fun book and one to to get. If you have a young emerging artist in your family, this is one to get for him or her.
At Gina Barreca's suggestion, we're doing a show on great books that nobody reads anymore. Have you heard of this? Because the online discussion group on this, somebody has chosen A Diary of a Provincial Lady, and it's a series by E.M. Delafield. And there's a whole housekeeping staff, sort of looks kind of Jeevesian on the cover. And so I think, wow, just based on the cover, this looks intriguing and fun. I love these old sort of eccentric English things. Mm-hmm. Ever heard of it? Diary of a Provincial Lady.
No. There are some other categories I put, which are books by contemporary authors who we know for certain kinds of works, like Hilary Mantel. Everybody's reading Hilary Mantel, I think, quite deservedly. You know, won the Booker Prize twice, first woman to ever have that particular achievement. Mm-hmm. And so we know from her from Bringing Up the Body, you know, her works about Henry VIII and his wives and the courts and Wolf Hall. She wrote some other wonderful books, one of which is very short, very fun read, called Flood, F-L-U-D-D. And it's about the devil going to a little town in northern England. And she packs into this tiny novel a moral sort of landscape populated with good and evil in its most essential forms. Again, really funny. It had been out of print for years, but since she's hit big with these new books, if you like Hilary Mantel, you would love her. And if you like Hilary Mantel, you will also, if you haven't read her lately, you should go back to Muriel Spark.
Uh-huh.
Right? Muriel Spark, people know her from the prime of Miss Jean Brodie. Again, if you're enjoying Downton Abbey, this is one of the connections that I was making. If you're enjoying Downton Abbey and you love Maggie Smith, you need to go back and see Maggie Smith in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which is a film worth rewatching. And Muriel Spark did the screenplay, adapted it from her own novel. But one of the books by Muriel Spark, all of her stuff is great, but one of the books by Muriel Spark that is underread and is just wonderful is called The Girls of Slender Means. And it's about...
Does it say Muriel Spark?
Muriel Spark. Mm-hmm. And it's about a sort of boarding house. It's set between VE Day and VJ Day in London. So it was after the war ends in Europe, but before it ends in Asia. It's about the girls who have been displaced. They're living in war-torn London, and about their ruthlessness, about their interactions, about their love affairs, about their ambitions. Another short novel where every single scene could have been its own novel, but with the sort of precise, short, sharp way that Muriel Spark writes, she gets it right on every page. Great book.
Gina Barreca, we're talking about great books that no one reads anymore. Gina has a list. I have a list. How about this? This is from the online discussion. Daphne du Maurier's Jamaica Inn.
Jamaica Inn. Now, okay, this is, again, amazing. Daphne du Maurier wrote Rebecca, wrote these fabulous books that are, again, worth going back to because they have this undercurrent, this sort of dark undercurrent about passions and repression and psychological entanglements that are great. Jamaica Inn, the place where she wrote it, the actual building is now up for sale in England. And one of my former graduate students, Margaret Mitchell, her name is actually, who teaches at the University of Georgia, in Carrollton, she put the ad for the place, Jamaica Inn, and said, can't we, all writers, you know, buy this place and use it as a retreat?
Another Yaddo.
Exactly, but really scarier and weirder and with better wine. But I think that Daphne du Maurier is somebody absolutely worth revisiting.
Okay, very quickly, the chat room says Pollyanna by Eleanor Porter. I've never read that.
I haven't either.
I wonder. Now I'm curious about that. That's so intriguing. Oh, so someone said The Yearling. And I think this is The Yearling is by Marjorie Keenan Rawlings. And I think, really, is no one reading that anymore?
No, I think actually these books, and so would Pollyanna be and Heidi, those are very much now taught in the new young adult and children's literature courses, which okay. UConn has a great version of it.
Gina Barreca, best idea. Thank you so much for coming on the show. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails that we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.